In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
There's a good argument to be made that people living in the Yukon are the most ignored voting bloc in the country. These folks don't get the same focus as those in Nunavut because there is no easy statement or a photo op for leaders to make about their policy by showing up. They don't get the same media coverage as the Northwest Territory because, well, climate change is every bit the problem in the Yukon. There's nowhere near the same expanse of coastline under threat. And they also don't get the attention of any other riding in Canada, really, because there's only one federal seat in the whole territory. And you can't claim support for First Nations issues or for climate change by winning it. You also have to go a long way just to get there. But what the Yukon does have is all the issues and challenges posed by its location, as well as some of the problems shared by cities like Toronto and Vancouver, where the economy is booming. So maybe the concerns of people living there could use a little more attention this month. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Chris Windier is a reporter at CBC North. He's based in Whitehorse. Chris, how's democracy going up in the Yukon?
Democracy is I guess, going well. It's proceeding relentlessly. You know, there are election signs starting to sprout on people's lawns and along the side of the road. We are having no fewer than 10 all-candidates debates
Wow.
over the course of the election here. Yeah, it's a lot. Last night, there was one on workers' issues sponsored by the Yukon Federation of Labor. Tomorrow night, there's one on nonprofits. And on Saturday, there's one on diversity and inclusion. And then there are more sort of coming down the pike in the coming weeks. So there are a lot of everybody sort of wants to have their debate on their issues. And the candidates don't always attend all of them, but you do get a fairly good sort of turnout. It's good for us in the news business. There's lots of debate to sort of cover, you know, how much those weigh on voters. I'm not exactly sure, but there are lots of chances at least to hear from the candidates.
What's the current makeup federally of the Yukon?
Federally, it's one riding, and that's held by Larry Bagnall, who has been a member of parliament since, I think it was 2000, apart from a brief interregnum starting from 2011 to 2015 when he lost to Conservative Ryan Leaf. Larry's been around a long time. He's really well known. He kind of volunteers for a lot of stuff, you know, like he'll volunteer for like music festivals and things.
Right.
So he comes from a nonprofit background, so that's pretty genuine, but also, you know, doubles as a helpful campaign tactic as well, I suspect.
Is he at risk this time around? We've talked to a lot of people from what were considered, at least after 2015, pretty safe Liberal ridings that are up for grabs now.
I would say that it's possible that Larry's at risk. The sort of right of center party in territorial politics, it's the Yukon Party. They're the Conservatives. You know, they tend to sort of be at a sort of reliable 35% plus pretty much constantly. So there's a solid constituency. You know, and the Conservative candidate, Jonah Smith, comes from a placer mining background up in Dawson City. He's a gold miner. There's still a lot of those guys around up here, of course. And the hard rock mining industry is also big. And the Chamber of Commerce scene is fairly strong. So he's got a fair amount of support and is a pretty well-known guy. So, you know, I think there's a challenge here for Larry. But he also, like I say, he's been around a long time and he does have a lot of support. So you cannot count him out. But I think it will be a competitive race this time.
How does the mood of the electorate up there ebb and flow compared to, you know, the saturation media coverage of the leaders down here for the last week? We've all been looking at whether or not Trudeau's brownface and blackface scandal would have impact on the voters at large. Are Yukoners impacted the same way or are they a little bit more removed from the frenzy?
I mean, it certainly bleeds up here for sure. There's always, you know, the coffee shop crowd are always going to sort of talk about the sort of main things that are in the news nationally. You know, we're not isolated from that here, but I think like the other territories, you know, we have relatively unique issues and concerns that are sort of distinct to us as a place. And the other thing is we don't have, obviously the territories don't have a ton of political power federally. We're not vote rich Ontario, as the saying goes, you know, so I think people give a lot of thought to who is going to sort of represent in Ottawa and sort of get stuff for us. And, you know, this is something that the Liberals were doing all over the country, but this summer, I mean, Larry Bagnall was carpet bombing the territory with funding announcements for a lot of stuff that municipalities and First Nations government needed, but it's the same strategy as elsewhere. So we're not immune from the sort of larger political calculations, but I think for voters, there's still a real, what are you going to do for me? Because no one else is going to do it because we're sort of forgotten up here sometimes a little bit.
So when those funding announcements were made, what were they for? And what do communities up there and First Nation governments up there still need?
There were a lot of funding announcements about energy and sort of like sewage, wastewater, those sorts of projects. For the last couple of weeks, Larry Bagnall has been announcing, along with Yukon Energy, the utility here, funding for battery storage for the hydro dam here. That's a big one because Yukon has an isolated hydro grid, and that is over capacity, and they have to run diesel and LNG to back it up in the winter. So they're trying to find sort of ways at the margins to get more out of the existing hydro network. So that's a big one. In a lot of cases, the municipalities have major infrastructure needs for stuff that isn't exciting, but water treatment, sewers, you know, municipal water supply and that sort of thing. Roads, as always, are a major thing. You know, so those sorts of things are always an issue. And that's sort of been the focus of a lot of the pre-election announcements that we've had up here.
We talked to Kent Driscoll from APTN, who covers Nunavut, a couple of weeks ago. And he described to me something that I guess I'd never put my finger on as a Southerner, which is that you see a lot of leaders in the North, a lot of federal leaders, at least in Nunavut, and they're always up there to talk about things they think will swing them some votes in the South. So is the Yukon treated the same way as Nunavut in that respect? And what kinds of things do you typically hear from the federal leaders about?
I don't think we get quite as much attention as Nunavut. Nunavut is unique in Confederation. They have more acute needs. And also, you know, for Southern political operators, it's sort of seen as a very, you know, scenic backdrop and a place where people go to sort of look prime ministerial. Not that you couldn't look prime ministerial in the Yukon, but I don't think we quite get, our needs are not as serious. You know, housing is a serious matter here, but it's not the desperate $2 billion shortfall that Nunavut is facing, the core housing needs. So, you know, there's less, I think, to be gained politically from coming to the Yukon, perhaps. We did have Andrew Scheer here this summer, and there was a lot of talk about carbon pricing. He was speaking to a Chamber of Commerce audience, you know, it was sort of a taxation and carbon pricing and natural resource industry heavy sort of talk. And that seems to be a lot of what comes up. Trudeau was here a couple of summers ago now to announce a major package of funding for a network of mining roads that sort of access the gold fields and the mineral deposits in the sort of west central part of the territory. And there's a lot of projects coming down the pike on that. So that tends to be a heavy matter of focus for leaders when they're here.
Well, I am kind of fascinated about the push and pull of that, because on the one hand, like you mentioned, you know, you need to get things up there and you need backups to the power grid. And so you need diesel and you need to burn carbon. But on the other hand, the North is kind of on the front lines of the climate crisis. And I wonder how voters up there or even just people you speak to reckon with that.
It's a very tricky proposition that we have here because Yukoners tend to have a fairly strong green streak. And even folks on the right of the political spectrum here tend to take climate change seriously as an issue. Not that they don't in other places. A big problem that we have is that there are not a lot of alternatives for people to go to. You know, if you live outside of Whitehorse, you need a car or you need to fly if you want to get to Whitehorse. There's no inter-community transit. The bus system in Whitehorse is pretty decent, but it doesn't run on Sundays. So there are these big gaps that make it really hard for people to just I'm going to quit driving and reduce my carbon footprint. You can't do that. So this is why, I mean, the carbon tax has been hugely controversial everywhere, but here as well, because there are not, you can't just get off furnace oil and you can't just not drive a car. So there have been a lot of folks who would be environmentally, I guess, sensitive and concerned about climate change, but also asking real serious questions about, like, how is this going to help when there's nowhere for me to go? There's nowhere to park my carbon footprint.
What kinds of infrastructure issues do you have as the climate crisis worsens? Because I know that a lot of stuff up there was built thinking it would always be frozen.
It's a very dramatic situation in a lot of coastal regions of the Arctic, as you're probably aware.
Yeah.
You know, coastal Alaska and the Northwest Territories, for example, you know, there's huge shoreline erosion problems, you know, and communities are literally facing being like washed out to sea. Don't quite have that level of concern here, but there's a lot of permafrost that is probably eventually become discontinuous. And that's going to create a whole host of issues. Just something as even as simple as like frosty on the highways. The Yukon has, I believe, the most kilometers of paved highway per capita in the country. And that's a huge burden on the territorial government to fund and to maintain those roads. And as climate change sort of gains even more traction, it's only going to become worse. And just the fact that, like, literally everything is built on ground that could become more and more unstable is a huge problem. And then there's all the issues of what is this going to do to wildlife? What's it going to do to habitat? What's it going to do to, like, traditional indigenous land use and knowledge? Those are all huge unknowns. And there's research and there are institutions here that are sort of working on those questions. But, you know, as with everywhere, it is sort of a race against time to sort of mitigate enough of these impacts before they really start to take hold. And, you know, again, like everywhere, nobody really knows how that's going to go.
The universal issue that keeps coming up as we kind of go across the country is that pocketbook issues now are more important to a large chunk of people than the climate of the future. So what is the economy like in the Yukon right now? And how does that compare to the rest of Canada?
The Yukon right now has what I believe is the lowest unemployment rate in the country. It's about 3% at last count.
Wow.
The economy is actually screaming right now. And, you know, I guess just to go back to political calculations, that always has to be good news for incumbents, at least helpful. There are a lot of reasons for that. You know, the resource industry is picking up again after sort of a period of low commodity prices, particularly base metals. But we also deal in gold, as you know, and that is a commodity that benefits from global economic uncertainty. And between the trade war with China and Brexit, there's plenty of that. So that's actually good news for the Yukon economy in a sort of weird way. And the other thing is that during the last economic slowdown, the Yukon Party government actually spent a lot of money and expanded the size of government in a sort of a Keynesian spending cycle to sort of keep the economy afloat. And it kind of worked. And it just goes to show that everyone is a social democrat when the federal government is paying, you know, roughly 85% of the bills. You know, so the economy is really good. And unlike some other places in the north, you know, we're having sort of that affluence disease. So we have an acute housing shortage in Whitehorse. So do a lot of places, but ours is sort of, it has more in common with, you know, say Vancouver or Toronto, just in terms of all these people moving here for work. And that is creating real supply issues. The vacancy rate for rental apartments in Whitehorse is extremely low. Housing prices are extremely high. They're not quite Iqaluit high, and rent is not Iqaluit high, but it's literally difficult to even find a place if you're looking to rent. I know I have friends who, you know, work solid middle-class jobs, and it's a challenge to even find a rental apartment sometimes, and people have to move a lot. So that's one of those sort of, you know, sort of one of those weird spinoffs of having a really strong economy, is that it really hits folks in the sort of middle income brackets and lower. Folks in the service industry have a real problem finding attainable and affordable housing. The McDonald's here was even posting ads a couple of months ago saying that, you know, if you work for us, we will, you know, if your rent costs more than a third of your income, we'll top it up so that you're paying a max one third of your income. So like McDonald's was like explicitly committed to affordable housing in a way that governments maybe aren't always. So that's kind of the situation. We, you know, it's a good problem to have. I'm sure there are plenty of places in Canada that would like to have that sort of overheating economy problem, but it does create real issues.
Is there any sense of it stabilizing or slowing down, or is this kind of growth something that whomever wins is going to have to deal with for the next however long?
You know, I mean, making economic predictions is always a risky proposition. So who knows? You know, the mining industry has been here obviously a long time, and that's always going to be like a major facet of the economy. The current Liberal government has put a lot of emphasis on trying to diversify the economy. They just announced $2 million in funding for this tech startup venture capital fund this week. Hmm. You know, so they're trying to sort of like get that sort of high-tech economy a little bit. There's, you know, Whitehorse is not just the sort of mining and transportation center that it used to be. It's, you know, it's a much more sort of diverse city, both economically and culturally. So, you know, that part of the equation is changing. Tourism is sort of a feast or famine thing, but it's really strong right now. And there's been a lot of emphasis on marketing outside of the territory for that. And that seems to have been paying off. But, you know, when your economy, as Alberta can tell you, you know, if you have a major interest in commodities, that can go away on you really quickly. So, you know, there's always that risk. But, you know, it's hard to say 5-10 years out what it's going to be like here.
If we're talking to you the day after the election and the seat has flipped, what would you say would have had to happen over the next 3-4 weeks?
The Conservatives will have been extremely successful in mobilizing their core supporters. Liberal supporters will have stayed home for whatever reason, and or one of the Green or the NDP have sort of come on unexpectedly strong. There is a bit of precedent for that in 2011 when Larry Bagnall lost to Ryan Leaf, the Conservative. There was a lot of sense that was in part attributable to a really strong Green candidate, John Stryker, who was a city councillor at the time and is now a cabinet minister with the territorial Liberals. And he got, I'm hesitant to give an exact number. I think it was around 18%, but that was way high for the Greens in this riding. And it seemed to be that a lot of that support came from Larry. The other thing that happened was there was a local polling company who put out a poll just before the election that showed the Liberals firmly in the lead. And a lot of Liberals like to blame that poll for getting Liberal voters to sit on their hands and stay home. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that. I'm a little skeptical about that one. But then the other thing was that the Conservatives had been hitting Larry Bagnall really hard over his vote in favor of the Longman registry. And that, you know, we are still a hunting society up here. And you know, that sort of stuff is important to a lot of people. So, you know, that hurt him. So I guess just to go back to your original question, and again, election predictions, you know, can make a fool of you in an awful hurry. But I do think that it does seem to be sort of a Liberal conservative race up here. It has been for this riding for a while. So if the seat does flip, it's going to be because Liberal supporters weren't exactly enthusiastic, and the Conservatives have done a good job of getting their vote out. I have to say that Jonah Smith's face has been on every bus in the city for months, and they had Andrew Scheer up here in the lineup. So I think that the Conservatives see this as a gettable seat, and they're really trying to flip it.
And we'll see if they get it. Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Chris Windier with CBC North in Whitehorse. That was the big story. We are now halfway through our Lay of the Land series. You can find them all at thebigstorypodcast.ca. We even have a special section right up top. Just click it. And of course, we will have more this week. If you want to talk to us about any of them or anything else, hit us up at thebigstoryfpn on Twitter and hit us up with a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or any other podcast platform that will let you. You can find us on all of them, of course, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify. Insert your favorite one here. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We'll talk tomorrow.